Hi folks, Jack Spirko here. Today you are listening to an episode of TSP Rewind. Commercial-free versions of past episodes. Podcast blasts from the past. I put these up when I can't do a show due to professional commitments or rare vacations. These podcasts will appear in standard iTunes, Stitcher, and other feeds, but will be titled TSP Rewind episodes and numbered accordingly. And today we're rewinding back to July the 28th, 2021, just about 5 years ago. This actually was never an official survival podcast episode. This was actually a Miyagi Mornings episode back when I was doing that. And I do believe it made it on the air as part of a Miyagi Mornings recap episode when I did those for a little while. But this never went up as a standalone show. So I thought it would be kind of a cool one to do in a rewind. I'll be back not tomorrow, but next week. So with one more rewind after this one. But maybe if I could throw you guys something that some of you at least have never heard before. Because a lot of you weren't around back in 2021 yet, even though we go way further back. We go back to 2008. But the other thing is, even when I was doing these Miyagi Mornings, it was very evident that not as many people were tuning into those as to the main podcast. So I'm sure there's people that missed it. And today's episode is, what would a deflationary global economy look like? And that's really the subject, but the actual title of the Miyagi Mornings was what would a deflationary global Bitcoin economy look like? And even if you're not a Bitcoin person, I think there's a lot to take from this episode, which is about 40 minutes long, so shorter than my average podcast, but still plenty of content for today, in that everything I'm going to say about what it would look like would apply to any form of deflationary currency or even a truly difficult to inflate currency, even something like gold, which tends to inflate around 2% per year. Remember, that is the Federal Reserve's target inflation rate is 2%. That's what they're supposed to do. Gold does it, but somehow gold doesn't work. And that's because when the Fed says 2% inflation, they mean the effective inflation, not the actual inflation of the monetary supply, which is just another way of saying the Fed likes doublespeak. So when they say inflation, they mean in measured prices of goods and services, where most people think of inflation only as the growth of the base monetary supply. Gold growing at 2% would be a perfect hard money with a 2% inflation, 2 to 2.5% per annual. And it's been that way for like 1,000 years, with like one or two arbitrary jumps in that, like when they found all the gold in the New World and stole it and brought it all back to Europe. Like, you take those out, and gold has 1,000-plus-year history of, you know, the most they can possibly do is pull 2% out of the ground, but somehow it doesn't work with a target inflation rate of 2%, because the 2% inflation rate means absolutely nothing, dog shit bullshit. And the reality is, at the progress of economy of scale, and in the advancement of technology, if you have a base monetary unit inflating at 2% of volume, not effect, you have no real inflation. In other words, as long as there's more than 2% growth, 2% growth in the monetary supply is deflationary. You see how that works, right? As long as we're growing at more than 2% growth, then less than that number in inflation of the monetary supply is a net zero or a net negative or deflationary. So the entire excuse as to why we can't use gold is bullshit. But, you know, Bitcoin would be infinitely better. But my point in all this is, if we go and analyze everything you're about to hear from 2021 and you threw gold into the mix, it would generally work as well. And we can still issue things like credit instruments against hard money. That's being done right now by Michael Saylor with Strategy and the various derivatives that have come off of Strategy as individual stocks like Strive and Strike, etc. So anyway, with that in mind, let's go ahead and cruise on back to July 28, 2021. Originally, Miyagi Mornings, episode 143, what would a Bitcoin deflationary global economy look like? And I can't wait to be back in a few more days, and we will be catching up on current topics. And remember, while these episodes are largely commercial-free, you can always help support us in two distinct ways. One, start your online shopping at tspaz.com, and the other would be, you guessed it, join the Members Support Brigade. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com/members to learn more about that. Well, hi, folks. Welcome to episode 143 of Miyagi Mornings. Today's episode is called, What Would a Deflationary Global Economy Look Like? Specifically, a Bitcoin deflationary economy. And I'm making sure I leave Bitcoin in the title, mainly because whenever I do a, you know, a show on Bitcoin or anything on cryptocurrency, it gets a lot of views, including from people that don't normally watch. So why would I take Bitcoin out of this? Because Bitcoin would be the most likely deflationary economy. It's where the question came from that vantage point. But this question I'm really going to answer today really has absolutely nothing to do with Bitcoin per se. Because the core of the question is about deflation. And we've been conditioned to believe that deflation is bad. Let me read this question. I love this question. Because this question is from Dan in Tennessee. And this shows that Dan is a long-term student of what we teach about money at TSPC. How would a deflationary economy work? If our entire economy was based on a currency with a fixed supply like Bitcoin, one, what's the velocity of money look like? See, the fact that he even knows to ask that question, I love that. Two, how is money lent, particularly for large long-term lending, houses, new factories, etc. Three, how is the economic growth affected or measured? Four, wouldn't percent of economic growth roughly translate to the percent of appreciation of the currency? You'd think so, but no, not really. But that's a great question. I'd like to hear your take on this. Thanks for all what you do, Dan in Tennessee. Okay, let's start out with, there are probably at least a few people that will listen to this and go, what the hell is the velocity of money? And I try to keep these Miyagi episodes, which in the original, you know, vision were like 8 to 10 minutes, 20 minutes-ish. And sometimes I go a little longer, sometimes a little shorter, but I can't explain all the terminology. So there are links in these video notes today where you can go listen to three podcasts I've done, really giving the kind of background Dan is drawing from. So if anything here doesn't make sense, I'd say go listen to those and come back and then listen to this again, and it probably will. But I think we have to really start out with something that's hard for us to do, and that's be honest that we have never experienced this thing that they've tried to make you afraid of. Everybody says, you know, all the experts, by the way, the same experts that told you not to worry about your money in the stock market in 07, 08, when I said get your money out, those guys, they all say deflation is horrible. You can find tons of examples of experts saying things like, man, deflation is a much bigger problem than inflation. And you might think I would just tell you those people are full of shit. They are, but they aren't. They are, but they aren't. Now, how does that work? Our economy, as we see it, as it exists right now, is built on an inflationary monetary system by intent and by design. So, of course, if everything you've built is designed for inflation and you get deflation, it's a problem, especially for the people that like control you through money, like your government, like the banks, like the corporations, right? And I'm not talking about the corporations like the kind of corporation I or some of you own. Those of you that own companies, you know what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the mega corporations that can borrow money for next to nothing, right? They can borrow money for less than the rate of inflation. That makes the money essentially free. It's a negative interest rate loan. And so governments, by having the power to print money, can do things that they normally, they basically can circumvent, you know, even though I'm opposed to any form of a state, states can be somewhat effective in that if a state doesn't have money and a citizen refuses to pay more taxes through, like, if you do this shit, we're going to either vote you out or drag you out, you pick, then you can actually put limits on what a government can do. They can only work with what they have, and now they have to start making decisions with what they have. If you have an artificially able to be inflated economy, there's literally no check on government. You put anybody you want in office, and the very power to print money becomes the absolute power that corrupts absolutely. And that's what we have. And so naturally, they don't want to give this up. So of course, they would create all these boogeyman stories. But one thing the gold bugs have right is that gold was money for more than 1,000 years, right? Let's just say 1,000 years. So how can something that kind of worked for 1,000 years all of a sudden not work anymore? And gold is not a totally deflationary economy. This is why I think that Bitcoin actually makes a harder money than gold, because if the price of gold goes up really high, people will dig deeper and harder for more gold. And so the total supply of gold has continued to increase in modern times, and it will continue to increase for the foreseeable future. It just is limited in its rate of increase. Where Bitcoin is, this is it, boys. You ain't getting no more. But what have I taught you guys about businesses when it really comes down to it? They'd rather have bad news that's known than potentially good news that's unknown. The more certain you are of a thing, the more you can plan long term. So a deflationary economy leads to the type of things that we had in this country, for instance, until we left it. When we all the way left it in the 30s through the 70s, that was a period in there, a transitory period where we went, that's real transitory. We went from gold back to partially gold back to no gold back in that period. What did we do before them? I want you know, anybody that's listening to the live stream, if you've been to New York City, let me know. Just say I've been to New York City or whatever. And if you have been, I want you to think about the architecture, the buildings, some of the churches. And there's other cities in the country that we can see this in, but none I think are as dramatic as New York City. Some of the churches in New York City are as absolutely artistically amazing as like great archaeology. The level of detail. Does anybody listening here in the comments know what I'm talking about? Like you've seen it and you've stood there and you've actually stared at some of this architecture, stared at some of these details, these sculptures. Almost it looks like somebody sculpted it out of sand, some artist in a sandcastle competition. And you just stand there in awe and you think of what kind of man hours were necessary to build something like this. Or when we came back from World War II, and especially when Ike got involved and we put together the intent to build the highways and bridge system that we were inspired by the Autobahn in Germany, the quality of that work, the fact that, yeah, it's fallen apart, but it's lasted like three times longer than it was supposed to. And you look at, they did all that work back then. Blue collar people made great salaries. My dad made more money working overtime on highway construction in that time period than most doctors running their own practice made at the time, right? And they were able to do that, and they built this incredible infrastructure. We can't even afford to maintain it today, and your reasoning behind it is inflation. That you have to start thinking about the harder the money, the longer the term of the money, then the longer the term of the infrastructure, we can build hard things instead of soft things. Today, all money goes into what? Technology, right? And most of it's code. It has no real cost of maintaining it. They talk about infrastructure. They're going to have an infrastructure bill for $6 trillion or something. They're not going to fix anything. Who here thinks, let me know, do you think they're going to fix anything in the live stream, right? They're not going to fix anything with this money. That's why they're referring. That's why you have, you know, retards like AOC saying, you know, childcare is infrastructure. They have no idea what the word infrastructure even means. We don't build great things anymore, and we can't even maintain the great things that we built. Now, I'm not trying to skate the question. I'm just trying to set the perspective. So let's start out with some of the parts of this wonderful question. What does the velocity of money look like? The short answer for those of you like, what the hell does that even mean? When you hear that inflation is they printed money, printing money doesn't actually cause inflation directly. It's an indirect thing. You print the money, if it doesn't move, if it doesn't go anywhere, if it doesn't get spent, and if it doesn't multiply, then it doesn't have really that much effect. We could print another $20 trillion tomorrow, put it, you know, in a bank account electronically somewhere out there and not spend any of it. It will have zero effect. And if we give it all to somebody who won't invest it, it won't do much with it, and we'll spend little bits of it, it won't have a huge effect either. The velocity of money is when that money gets spent and respent and respent, and more when it ends up in deposits in bank and then they lend out against it. So it's lending, because remember, when banks lend money, they don't lend money that they have. They create a promissory note on their books based on your promise to pay the money back. They don't actually give you money from their deposits. They're, when they write a check to you, they're writing a check back by nothing but you. You are the backing of that. So when you go borrow $250,000 to build a house, you don't get $250,000 from the bank. They make brand new $250,000 out of thin air. And that increases the monetary supply. And the more money they have, the more money they can loan. And the more money that circulates, the more money people can borrow. And that leads to a relatively quick velocity of money. There's where your inflation actually comes from. So what happens to the velocity of money when we go into a deflationary, not period? We have to separate this. Deflationary period is the 1970s. It's stagflation. It's things went wrong. We're supposed to have inflation. The thing was, everything is designed for inflation, and now we have deflation. That's a disaster. I don't say that it isn't. However, when you have a design deflationary standard and people know that that's it, what it does, it absolutely slows down the velocity of money because it favors savers, it favors investors in hard investments, and it disfavors reckless borrowing and borrowing in general. There's a famous quote that's something like, gold is the money of kings. Silver is the money, I think, of nobles. Barter is the money of peasants. And debt is the money of slaves. And in a hard money system, that's true. In a soft money system, debt is the money of kings. Because the kings don't borrow the money, they lend it. And so it is the same but different, man, once again. So you have a slower velocity of money. Then how does that affect borrowing, right? Because let's say that I need to build a house, and we've gone to a Bitcoin standard, and I need 2.5 Bitcoin to build a house because it's gone way, way up, and I'm building a really nice house for that. Now I have to pay back my borrower in the currency that I bought, and I am now paying that lender back at a rate that whatever my interest rate is, I need to add to it the deflationary rate of the currency. How much more valuable is it? How much harder do I have to work for the same amount every year? Right? Because since the money becomes stronger, you see how that works? Like it starts to bite in the other direction. Well, yes and no. So we have this idea. It's the same thing that leads people to ask you questions like, well, if you go keto and you start losing weight, what's to stop you from losing weight? Well, your body's balanced. Your body doesn't just keep running. Like, you don't go keto and go from 300 pounds to 180 and look great, and then you just keep losing weight and you end up down at like 95 pounds and you look like you were in a gulag. Did I say gulag? Anyway, yeah, like that doesn't happen, right? Like you reach a point where since you're doing the right thing, you reach a stasis. So there is a transitory period that is a bloodbath coming in this, if it happens, right? Because remember, I've not said Bitcoin will become the global reserve currency. I said it will become a global reserve for currencies. And that's a different thing than we're talking about today. We're talking about dreamland where this happens. So as this occurs, people that have Bitcoin will hoard it like never before. And this part will happen. As more and more people compete for what's left, and it drives it up. But there comes a point where if you're a Bitcoin multi-billionaire, what are you going to do? Just like look at your ones and zeros? You're going to go out and spend it. There does come a point where you're like, you know what? I'm going to go buy myself a yacht. I'm going to go build a company because I want to build shit, right? So like eventually some of this money then starts to move. And no matter what gets hoarded, you get to a point of equalization. And then you get into a much more what the gold economy looked like before we screwed it up. You get into a point where money basically becomes very, very stable, and maybe it goes from, you know, 200. Right now, Bitcoin over any five-year period has 200% annualized returns. Well, that can't go on forever, right? And if you start looking at, well, what do certain prices of Bitcoin mean? $1 million Bitcoin means one Satoshi is a penny. So it's easy from there, isn't it? $5 million Bitcoin, one Satoshi is a nickel. $10 million Bitcoin, which is when you get Bitcoin into kind of the market capitalization value of gold, a Satoshi is a dime. And if you look around your society today, what do you want that a dime would be too expensive for? And as that number goes up, the amount that it can go up becomes limited. Now, somebody's going to be like, Bitcoin's crazy, you know, you're nuts. You know, it's just a scam. It's a pyramid. No, just, I don't have time for you today. I don't have time for anybody like that today. We're saying if it was adopted, how would it work? And I'm telling you that there would come a point where people could do business, transact in Satoshis. And so maybe thinking in Satoshis rather than whole Bitcoins is a better way to do this. And now you end up with something that's much more level. You end up with something where, you know, Bitcoin is going up over time about 2-4% in value. So who really has a problem with, you know, let's say 3-5-6% on loans? I mean, I know right now when you hear 6% on a mortgage, you're like, holy shit, right? Okay, that's because you live in an upside down world. You don't know that, like, it wasn't that long ago. I mean, it really wasn't that long ago. Like 5-6% on a mortgage was like nobody even batted an eye at it. It was like, oh, that's pretty good, right? And so what does this lead to? This leads to when I buy a home, we start living more like our grandparents did. You ever wondered why they did this? Because they had the vestiges, the last vestiges, the whispers, the memories of this type of life. They bought a house, and when they had an extra kid, what did they do? Did they, like, get a giant SUV and move to a new house and call their first house a starter house? No, they added on a room. They added on, and they took care of shit, didn't they? They valued it. And they paid it off over time. And in the middle of this, we switched from this very stable economy to this falsely manipulated economy. And it benefited people initially because my grandfather remortgaged his home right before he was shipped off for World War II to make sure he could put some money into my grandmother's hands. And he mortgaged the entire almost the entire value of his property, which was about a 1.5-acre homestead in Pennsylvania with like a 4-bedroom house on it, for $1,300. And by the time he came back from the war, my grandmother had already managed to take the money he was sending home as a soldier and pay it down by like 70%. And then as soon as he got a job as a carpenter, they paid it off like that. Now, that's a different world. But what happened is people started to understand this game and say, well, then I can go buy this house. And then as the value of money declines against the loan, it's actually really cheap money. And during a period from the 40s through the 60s, this was really, really beneficial during the time the boomers were getting born to the World War II generation who came back and had jobs to take on and could make good money. So they became sold on it because they benefited from the transition without an understanding of what they were doing to their children, their grandchildren, and their great-grandchildren. In their minds, they couldn't see that one day a house that you could easily buy for $20,000 was going to be worth $1 million, and they couldn't figure out how that would be a problem because they had never seen it before. It didn't make any sense. They had one real flaw that generation. They trusted our government. And they thought, and it was even worse, they thought they were trusting the government and they were trusting the banks. So lending would end up equalizing. Economic growth, how would it be affected or how would it be measured? Economic growth, we think in dollars and it needs to go up. Economics should be measured in, can the average person who does a good day's work and brings value to the market afford to live well? That's how we should be measuring our economics based on the quality of life of individuals and the stability long term of that quality of life. Because how many of you, back to the live feed here, have seen a person that looked like they were doing great? I mean, especially like they went into a business for themselves or something, like in the construction industry during a housing boom. And they're driving like a $50,000 pickup truck. They got no problems. They built themselves a house. They're just doing great. They have like 10, 15 people working for them, and the housing market takes a crap. And everything was built on this tower of nonsense and in this inflationary manipulated economy. And somebody in the banking system decided, yeah, we're growing too fast. So they actually slow the economy down on purpose. Fed does that all the time. Or the system just starts to break down and they keep pumping money in and it doesn't work. You have a much more stable environment. You know, when I've mentioned the book Rich Dad, Poor Dad. In that book, one of the things Rich Dad tells young Robert, again, it's a fable, but it's still a great piece of information as far as it goes as a book. He says, well, Robert says to him, well, shouldn't prices go up? And he says, no, in a well-ordered and run economy, prices should go down. Prices should go down. And so that's we would measure economic growth as the suppression of price inflation is capped. And then you have an equalizing economy where people can go out with certainty and knowledge and invest long term in themselves, mostly just by saving some of what they make without fear that it will be eroded. It will slow down investment, but what it'll slow down is the investment in I'm trying to get rich quick. It'll push investments into the very long term time horizon. And if you ask me, we were much better off as a civilization when we invested in building that way. I think of those churches in New York City where I look at them and I say, we literally cannot build this today. But they built this in the 1890s, in the 1880s. How have we fallen so far? We can't build a building today. We can't afford to build a building today that they built 100 to 120 years ago. How weak have we become because of this tit of printing on-demand money? And wouldn't economic growth roughly translate into the appreciation of the currency? Okay, let's say that it does. So let's say that the currency appreciates at 2%. Okay? Anybody got a problem with long-term sustained 2% growth of the economy? I don't at all. What does that result in? It results in stability. It results in long-term thinking. It results in people investing very conservatively instead of very aggressively. It results in people thinking differently, a little bit more like our grandparents and great-grandparents. Anybody here think it would be bad if we all thought a little bit more like our grandparents did? Especially if you're like my age. I don't know. If like your grandparents are my age, maybe not so much. I'm a freaking unicorn in my age demographic. What about my grandparents? I'm talking about my grandfather who was so old in this world that not only did he go to World War II, he went as a fairly older man and he was almost old enough to get drafted into World War I. Not quite, but almost. Like, I'm talking about that generation. Do you know a first generation Ukrainian immigrant that came through Romania to get here because you couldn't get here directly from Ukraine at that time? Do you really think we wouldn't be better off if we thought more like that than what you see around you today? That's what a deflationary economy looks like. The transition, God only knows. And that's why I say get your hands on some hard money right now. And yes, that would be Bitcoin. That is the hardest money we have. I would also say it is gold and it is silver. I mean, there's going to come a point where this is all going to come to a reckoning. And as soon as the elite figure out how to make it work for themselves, they'll do it. And we'll talk about that in a future episode. All right, guys. Hope you liked that one. Went 23 minutes, but that's okay. Let me get this exported out over here. And I will answer any questions that you have in just a second. If you guys want to ask me, those of you that heard the beginning of this, that found out that I am currently infected with COVID, I'm going to stay really brief on that just to tell you I'm fine. Look at me. I am thinking about doing some sort of like an AMA for that on Float and Odyssey only, though, because it will not go well for me if I do it here on Bitcoin. All right, I got that exporting. Let's see what's going on over in Floatland. Good morning. Love the topic. From Darren and Dodo. Neat, Darren. Okay, that's from somebody else. Hard money architecture equals soft money architecture. Yeah, hard money architecture is greater than soft money architecture. I agree. First time on float, thank Jack from Mark Ortiz. Jim's, couldn't watch on Odyssey. It was skipping bad. Nice stream here. Jim's, maybe if you were on Odyssey, it could have happened, but it, I have found that people seem to do much better on Odyssey with the being, you know, on a browser rather than using the app. Or, you know, if they're actually on library. So you might want to check that. And Shoop says, my grandmother could fix just about anything, depression era, and had to think about things entirely differently. Yeah, I remember my grandfather and me sitting in a little boat in the middle of a river and him tapping on a carburetor with a screwdriver and thinking, well, that was disconcerting there. Anyway, am I going to have to freaking swim the boat in for the old man? And he got that thing running. Chicago architecture is nice too. Yeah, it is. And it's the oldest stuff that is the most, you know, mind blowing. Said Odyssey had a problem this morning. So I'm going to flip over to Odyssey. Some people were on Odyssey. Jim Seifert says, hi, Jack. Liberno Farms says, morning. Sorry y'all got the COVIDs. Yeah, that's what I call it. That's what I got that from Jeff Berwick. I call it that for a different reason. We'll talk about that during my AMA. Freedom Arizona says, New York City. Yes. Yes, I've been. Jim Seifert. Italian immigration built many of them. Yeah, Italian immigrants did build many of them. For sure, man hours and craftsmanship. It's through the roof, isn't it, guys? Italy has amazing Duomos. Yep. Freedom AZ, never been, only have seen pics and vids. You know, when things go back to pseudo-normal, I don't really, like, I'm big on the whole New York City's a great place to live, but I would, or great place to visit, but I wouldn't want to live there. It is worth going. It is worth going. And I'll tell you something, if you want to see history in a totally different way, there's a place called the Chapel that stood. And it's a little chapel right down by the World Trade Centers. And it is like when all those buildings fell, they basically fell around this chapel. And the first president of the current version of the United States, because, of course, he wasn't actually the first president of the United States, a little trivia there, George Washington sat in that pew and prayed in that church. I'm not a big worshiper of the founders, but I am a man who stands in awe of real history. And there's a lot of history there as well. Odyssey performance may be degraded. You can try to use it in 5 minutes. Please don't crush us. It's back up now, Tom says, over on Odyssey. So anyway, Odyssey doesn't seem as stable on the live feed as Float does or YouTube does for now. I'm sure Jeremy and his buddy, his boys are working really hard over there. So does anybody have any questions or thoughts for me? And enter them in all caps in the chat if you do, with today's subject, with deflationary currencies. And does it make sense what I've kind of put in perspective? I want you to think about the greatest things that mankind's ever built. Like even going back into what we would refer to as ancient history, which is, I think, is far more current history than we've been led to believe. I think the history of civilization and mankind is far older than academia teaches us. But if you look through, you know, even like the Roman Empire, think about the fact that there are parts of the aqueducts that haven't been maintained in 1,000 years. That honestly, if we had our shit together, you could turn them back on and they would work. We can't keep a road around. Maroads, we can't keep a road around for like 3 or 4 decades without falling apart. Highway 20 going through the southern part of Dallas-Fort Worth isn't that old. And just, it was like 15, 20 years ago, they had to drill holes in it and pump concrete underneath it because it was sinking, right? And the Romans built roads that, for all intents and purposes, still work. What was the currency of Rome when they were building these things? Was it fiat dollars? Was it Caesar notes? It was gold and silver, and as it began to fall apart and they tried to make more money out of thin air, it became bronze. But even with that, it was a fundamentally hard-capped currency. There was no way you could just say, oh, just add, you know, a gazillion dollars more to the economy. Everything we've ever built that became a wonder of mankind, that didn't fall apart, was built with hard money. Because as soon as you get into the denarius, Bob Collins says, and it was denarius was silver, right? A silver denarius. I think a Roman soldier was paid one denarius a day. Is that right? I don't remember. It's either one denarius or 10 denarius. I think it was one denarius a day. And a denarius, I think, had an equivalent amount of silver to roughly the silver that a U.S. silver dime had in it until 1964. But I could be wrong about that. That's way back the last time I visited that topic. But yeah. How much harder would our current money be if debt almost none on average? I don't know what that means, Jesse. How are you saying how much harder would our current money be if there was almost no debt? Yeah, 1/10 of an ounce, Bob says, on a denarius. That's what I thought. And I think Roman soldiers were paid like 30 denarius a month. So 3 ounces of silver a month. And they were well paid. Being a Roman soldier was a good paying job. So imagine being paid 30 silver dimes a month. Yeah, so Hayes says where that ounce is 90%. So yeah, an American silver dime is a 90% silver coin. So it's not quite the same, but I don't know what the actual percentage of silver in a denarius, but I'm sure it wasn't 100%. Maybe it was. I don't know. But it's a good way to think about it. So I think if there was no debt, I don't think you're going to ever have a society with no debt. I think that it is natural that some people have more money than they need, and some other people need more money than they have. And I don't mean that they need more money so they can buy a bowl of porridge. I mean that people that actually have the ability to build great things need more money to do a thing than they have money on hand to do the thing with. And that the thing itself has a return that exceeds what the lending cost would be. And that's what happens. You start getting into a place, if personal debt levels were low or nil. Yeah. Yeah. I think personal debt is evil. I think that, you know, borrowing at the rate we do as individuals today is insane. And it coincides directly with decoupling from the gold standard. The personal debt in the United States was very low from the 1960s all the way back to the original existence of the United States. People that had debt were, you know, the farmers. That, you know what a farmer is? It's a businessman. People that had debt borrowed money to invest in income-producing activities. I need to borrow money to buy seeds so I can plant cabbages and cauliflower. I need this much money, but the crop's value should be this much more money. That's how decisions were made with borrowing, where when we borrow money to buy a house today, you know the number one way people make that decision, guys? They look out at the world and they say, you know, my cost to rent an apartment is X. If I can buy for anything close to X, I should. That's the number one decision-making thing in a person's mind today about buying a house. And then they say to themselves, How good of a house can I get for that money? And then they go look for a house in that bracket for that money, and they don't even think, gee, over 30 years, I'm going to actually pay $575,000 for a $180,000 house. They don't even care. That's gone away. They don't think that way. Where if you can say, see, this is the other side of it. Like, have you ever thought about another reason people buy houses? Trying to save money to buy a house while the housing market's going up and the value of money is going down just doesn't work. So the government comes in and offers, you know, 3% down FHA loans. And most people can cobble together 3% of the purchase price. Then they finance all the freaking bullshit closing costs, half of which are totally unnecessary. And then they put the person into debt for more than the value of the home right out of the gate, even though they supposedly have equity in it. They don't really. Like, why people do this to themselves? Because they're not even thinking about keeping that house for 30 years. They're not even thinking. Most people buy a house, they never intend to pay it off. That's where the term starter home comes from. Like I was saying earlier, our starter homes were built. That's your starter home. And what it meant was, this is what we can afford to build now. Now we'll save money. And if money goes up in value and you're saving money, you're actually able to accumulate enough to do something with it. Whereas right now, as you save money in this little pile, it's like the government, if real inflation's 7% even, 8%. So for every $100 you save, it's like an invisible thief comes and takes $8 per hundred out of it. And I would say real inflation right now is more like 15% this year. I don't know if that's sustainable. Michael Saylor says it is. I don't know if it is, but it is right now. So for every $100 you hold without putting at risk this year, you're going to have $85 in value at the end of the year. How can you possibly, on a normal person's salary, ever accumulate enough? Instead of, you stop thinking in total dollars and think in relative value. You can't. You're trying to build something. It's like you're in school, like in kindergarten, right? And the big stupid kid who failed twice, every time you put the third block on your tower, the kid comes and knocks it off and pushes you down. So you put three more blocks on, he knocks two off and pushes you down. And just when you think you're getting somewhere, he kicks the bottom out from underneath and smacks you. There's your that's what inflation is. No matter how, so the only thing you can do then is go hide your blocks in a locker, and hopefully the teacher will give you an extra block in interest, 1%. And you still have lost value, right? You'll never have a house. That's what this system is like. That's kind of one of the more simple analogies I can come up with. Because what happens is you're trying to save money, you either need to get into a home, if you're thinking about the biggest long-term purchase people make, or you have to put your savings at risk substantially to beat inflation, which is why they did it in the first place. Anyway.
And with that, I'll just let you know that the original way that this ended was with me promoting that day's actual podcast. And so that was where we will end that discussion. Hope you enjoyed it. Again, you'll have one more day of rewinds, and I will be back again starting next week. Remember, our new schedule is 3 days a week, which is how many rewinds you happen to get this week. So our next live episode will be Tuesday of next week. And there'll be one more rewind between then and now.